Good morning, everybody. There is something I've noticed about our culture today, and this is by no means a culture bashing sermon, but just an observation, and I am just as equally guilty of this as the next person, so please understand I'm not trying to put anyone in a particular category, because I'm there myself. But when is the last time you went somewhere that was semi-public, and there were people that were waiting for something to be accomplished for them or done for them, and they didn't have their phone or tablet or Kindle or iPad out? For me, it's been a good little while. I find myself when I'm waiting at the DMV, or I'm waiting for an oil change, or I'm waiting for really anything, I'm in a waiting room or in a lobby, and my first just natural reflex is to reach into my left pocket and pull my phone out. I know no one has texted me. I have no one to really communicate with. I have no goal. I have nothing I need to get done right then. It's just a reflex to pull my phone out. And I begin to think about why that's a reflex. Well, I'm of a generation where cell phones weren't absolutely everywhere when I was a kid. I had to wait until I was 18 before I could go buy my own phone, and then it became a part of me. But before then, it wasn't really a thing. And so it's still new, but it's still foreign. And so I can only imagine of kids that are growing up after me that this becomes such an essential part of daily life that it's not even a consideration, I would assume, for many young people. And so I wonder why that is. And the more I think about it, and the more that I reflect on what I'm trying to do when I pull my phone out, it's not just waste time by playing a game, or it's not just the idea of trying to check my email to make sure I'm not falling behind on something. It's, I want there to be someone there waiting with me. It's what I think I'm trying to do. I'm trying to tell someone, hey, I've got a couple of minutes. Do you want to catch up? I want to text somebody so I don't feel like I'm just sitting here in this room in a chair by myself, alone. I want to know that I have someone that I'm connected to who's right there with me while I'm in this space by myself. And I think that's probably most people's just interaction, whether they want to admit it or not. They don't want to feel like they're just here alone in this room waiting for something. Recently, I was at the DMV, which if y'all have not experienced that, it's a pleasure. I knew going into it that I was going to have a couple of hours to probably kill. Fortunately, the DMV I went to in Somerville was just, they were on their game. And it was just as much fun watching all those people at the DMV from all their various backgrounds and clothing options and hair colors and styles. It was fun just being a part of that for a little while. But I had my phone with me, and I had synchronized to my phone a bunch of journals from biblical sources of a paper I was trying to research and study for. And so I had work to do, but I felt like I had to have something in my hand because everybody else had a phone in their hand. And so I didn't want to be the only one just kind of sitting there like a loaf waiting for someone to start a conversation with me, which I really didn't want at the DMV. But it's just one of those things that the more I focus on, the more I think about it, we are a culture, we are a world now that is as connected as we can possibly be. I could text, phone call, or video call my mother in Virginia anytime I want. I could call my 92-year-old grandma in the middle of the afternoon and I could talk to her. I could email, text, or video call a preacher I know in the middle of Kenya near Nairobi, and he could answer and take my video call. I can connect with virtually anyone in the world, virtually anytime, virtually for free, virtually with no caveats at all. And yet, I think we have a huge problem in our society today with people feeling lonely. People feel like they are alone. And I think what they are doing, myself included, is trying to connect with people because we feel so disconnected with everybody else. One of the great things about the Bible is it tells us the same thing that we've been told for thousands of years about our Creator God. But the book is written in such a way to where based on our culture, based on our world, the place where we find ourselves, it's still relevant. And while mass communication, mass media, these were not available in the first century, the Word of God has so much to say about our desire to connect with someone, literally anyone, when we are in certain moments of life. And so this morning what I want to do is look into a certain number of passages and see this thread as it develops throughout the Old and New Testament. Let's begin in the book of Genesis chapter 26. I will say I had to be very selective in what verses I went to because we could be here all afternoon. And so I'm going to give you just little threads to follow, little points and dots to connect as we go through, and hopefully we end up somewhere where I think we should. And in Genesis chapter 26 and verse 24, this is God speaking to Isaac after Isaac has kind of taken up the mantle from his father Abraham, who was called to go out away from his father's house, away from the place that he knew so well in Mesopotamia, and he was called to go out to what we know as the land of Canaan. He didn't know that at the time. He was just told to go. And so he went. And that's, in and of itself, amazing. But his son Isaac is now taking up that charge, possessing this land, and following God's directions to become a patriarch. So in Genesis chapter 26, verse 24, we find this little statement. The Lord appeared to him, talking about Isaac, the same night, and said, I am the God of Abraham, your father. What an introduction, by the way. God says, hey, look, I'm your father's God. If you didn't know who I was, fear not, for I am with you and will bless you and multiply your offering for my servant Abraham's sake. Now, sometimes what I do is I just read through verses like it's a novel and I just miss all the nuance. So I slow down whenever I can remember to and try to pick up on little phrases that seem out of place. To me, what seems out of place here is this little statement that God makes to Isaac, which we have no context for. It says, fear not. And so I would assume that God knew that Isaac was somehow afraid about something. He says, for, or because, don't be afraid, because I am with you. Now, in this world, he couldn't just pull his cell phone out and call a friend. He couldn't just FaceTime somebody. He couldn't just shoot an email or a Facebook update or a Twitter update. He couldn't do those things. He was kind of on his own here. And so what God did was he interrupted his fear by saying, look, don't be afraid. I'm God, and I'm with you, okay? You're not alone in this. Let's jump forward here to chapter 26, Genesis 26. Begin reading in verse 10. We've been here before in a previous sermon, so I'll kind of read through quickly. Jacob left Beersheba and went towards Haran. This is Genesis 28:10. And he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and laid down in that place to sleep. He dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder or staircase set up to the earth, or set up on the earth, and the top of it reached unto heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your grandfather, father, and the God of Isaac. So once again, you have the son of Isaac, Jacob, here in this location. We know from the context, running from his life because his brother Esau wants to kill him for some reason. And then Jacob looks up to heaven in a vision and sees God. And God introduces himself, listen, I am God. I'm the God of your grandfather. I'm the God of your father. And now I'm making your acquaintance, Jacob. I am the God of Abraham, your father, the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west, to the east, to the north, to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So again, he is reiterating the Abrahamic promise to the grandson Jacob, through whom we have the Israelites later in history. But notice this. Behold, God says, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised. And then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. He called that place Beth-El, the house of God, Bethel. And so you have Isaac being introduced to God. First thing God says, don't be afraid, I'm with you. You have Jacob, later called Israel, meeting God, and God says, listen, don't be afraid, I'm with you wherever you go. I'm never going to leave you until I've accomplished what I need to accomplish through your seed line, bringing about Jesus, we know later in history. Now, over in the book of Joshua chapter 1, this is kind of jumping forward a bit. We're past the book of Exodus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and Leviticus, and we're into Joshua. So Moses was the man of God who led the Israelites from captivity in Egypt, led them all the way to the border of the Promised Land. Moses himself died before they could cross over the Jordan and conquer that land. And so who was going to take the place of Moses? The great man mediator, Moses, for alliteration's sake. It was going to be his second-in-command, his right-hand guy, Joshua. And so Joshua is trying to fill Moses-sized shoes, which are big shoes to be sure. So in Joshua chapter 1, beginning in verse 1, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, Moses, my servant, is dead. Therefore, now arise, and go over this Jordan, you and all the people, into the land that I am giving to them, to the people of Israel. Every place the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given to you, just like I promised to Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon forest, as far as the great river, River Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites towards the great sea north, going towards the down of the sun, shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Meaning you are going to find victory after victory after victory. Don't be afraid. You can do it. And then this last little bit, just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you or forsake you. That last little bit is so personal. I'm not going to leave your side. You're not going to be alone. You are never going to be desolate, disconnected from God. He's with you. This is a resounding theme throughout the Old Testament. Let's jump forward here to the book of Jeremiah. This is where all this began, by the way. I was reading Jeremiah, or having it read in the car, books on tapes on a thing, so book on iPhone, I guess, I don't know. Jeremiah chapter 1 was being read, and this point just kept popping up. Jeremiah 1 verse 4, now the word of the Lord came to me saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I consecrated you. I appointed you a prophet to the nations. And then I said, Lord God, behold, I don't know how to speak. I'm only a youth. I'm only a kid. The Lord said, don't say I'm only a youth. For to all to whom I send you, you shall go. And whatever I command you, you shall speak. Don't be afraid of them. Why? Because or for I am with you to deliver you, declares the Lord. Drop down to verse 17 of this context, Jeremiah 1:17. But you, dress yourself for work, arise, and say to them everything that I command you. Don't be dismayed before them, lest I dismay you before them. And I, behold, I make you this day a fortified city, an iron pillar, bronze walls, against the whole land, against the kings of Judah, its officials, its priests, and the people of the land. They will fight against you, but they shall not prevail against you. Why? Because I am with you, declares the Lord, to deliver or save you. He says, Jeremiah, look, I know how you think about yourself, but before you were even a thing, before you were a baby in your mom's womb, I knew exactly who you were. You can do this, and I'm going to be with you every step of the way. That's powerful. That's powerful. Isaiah chapter 41, beginning in verse 8. This is not about Isaiah, it's about the people of Israel who are going to go away to captivity. Isaiah 41 and verse 8, "But you, Israel, my servant Jacob, whom I have chosen, the offspring of Abraham, my friend, you whom I took from the ends of the earth and called from its farthest corners, saying to you, you are my servant. I have chosen you and not cast you off. Fear not, why, Israel? For I am with you. Don't be dismayed. Why? For I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand." This is God through Isaiah saying, look, nation of Israel, things are going to get rough. But don't be afraid. God is still with you, even through captivity of Assyria, the Babylonians, Medo-Persian Empire. God was there the entire way. Now we step back from this and we see this point. God makes it pretty clear that He's with His people. He wants them to not be afraid, but to rely and trust in Him. There is one psalm that I would like to read together, the whole thing, if we can, for sake of time. It's in Psalm 73. In Psalm 73, this is not, as far as we know, a psalm of David. It's what we call a psalm of Asaph. We don't know if that was a guy, or if that was a generation, or if it was a pseudonym for David. We don't know for sure. But if you read the emotions within Psalm 73 with me, we'll see the exact connection, not from God's perspective, but from mankind's perspective about this principle. Let's begin reading here. Psalm 73. "Truly, God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled, my steps had nearly slipped, for I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked." Man, if you've not felt that yet, tell me your secret. What he's saying here is, I know that God is good, and He wants to bless us, to those that are doing right things. But I see other people who aren't living the right life, but they've got a good life. And He wanted it. He wanted the good life that they had from His perspective. Verse 4, "For they have no pangs until death. Their bodies are fat and sleek." Now, in this culture, having a fat body was a good thing, right? Because it meant they had enough food on the table. So they were wealthy, they were fat, they were sleek. "They are not in trouble as the others are," verse 5. "They are not stricken like the rest of mankind, and therefore pride is their necklace. Violence covers them like a garment. Their eyes swell out through fatness. Their hearts overflow with follies or wickedness. They scoff and they speak with malice or hate, and loftily they threaten opposition. They set their mouths against the heavens, and their tongue struts through the earth. And therefore, His people turn back to them and find no fault in them. And they say," verse 11, "how can God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are the wicked, always at ease. They increase in wealth, and all in vain. I have kept my heart clean and washed my hands of innocence." He's saying, look, they're living a life, and they've got a lot. They're boastful, they're arrogant, they're prideful, but they're doing well for themselves. And here I am over here trying to live the right lifestyle, and I'm not living like them. Something must be wrong with how I perceive this situation. And verse 14, "For all the day long I have stricken and rebuked every morning. If I had said, thus I will speak, I would have betrayed the generation of your children." So I try to change my life to try to match theirs, but I don't want to compromise my belief and my faith in your commandments. And then verse 16, "But when I thought how to understand this," when I tried to figure it all out, "it seemed to me a wearisome task until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I discerned," I figured out their end. He's trying to figure out why bad people are being blessed and why good people are having such a hard time. So I couldn't figure it out until I communed with God, because God told me what their end looks like versus what my end looks like. That's what it's all about. In verse 18, there's a shift in the tone. Truly, you, God, have set them in slippery places. You make them fall to ruin. How they are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors, like a dream when one awakes. O Lord, when you awake or rouse yourselves, you despise them as phantoms. They have a blessed, good, wealthy, luxurious life. It can be gone like this. Verse 21, when my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in the heart, I was brutish and ignorant. I was like an animal or a beast towards you and my ignorance of what their life is like in comparison to mine. And then verse 23, nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I want or desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. What the psalmist is saying here is, I looked at people that were doing well, and I wanted what they had. But then I realized I didn't need that fleeting wealth because I had God with me the whole time. I love this imagery of verse 23. I'm continually with you. You hold my right hand. Small diversion of the subject. Last night, Maddie was going to be put down at about 8 o'clock. She was exhausted by 7. I bought mouthwash from Target yesterday, and I brought it home, and it was just the greatest thing in the world to her. She wanted to carry around these 2 bottles of mouthwash, one blue, one green. And she put the blue one on a blue chair, and the green one on a green chair, and said, color, boo. I go, yes, ma'am, that's blue. She goes, color, green. I go, green, yes, ma'am, you got it right. That was the greatest thing. But I had to take the mouthwash away because she was starting to throw it, so I didn't want it to bust everywhere. So I took it away. She lost her marbles. Everything was over. Tears, drool. She lost her mind. I go, okay, 7 o'clock. I have one more hour. One more hour. What can we do? SpongeBob. SpongeBob came through in the clutch. So Netflix, SpongeBob. I'm like, all right, we got this. We can sit through 2 annoying episodes of SpongeBob until it's time to go to sleep. So she was laying down on the couch on her stuffed turtle, had a blanket wrapped around her. She was chill, finally. And so I'm exhausted. What do? I lean over against her, and I put my head next to her. And she takes her little hand, and she starts to stroke my hair. And I go, oh, of course, you're going to be really angry, then be really, really sweet. And I put my arm around her little body, and she took her hand, and she grabbed my hand, and she held my hand and patted it. And said, okay, okay. I go, yes, ma'am, I'm okay. Are you okay? Yeah. I go, okay, let's watch SpongeBob. And so when I read that God is holding my hand this whole time, being there with my little girl and her holding my hand is the greatest thing that I can think of. How does it get any better than that? But what we see here in Psalm 73 is that connection. God has said consistently, don't be afraid, I'm going to be with you every step of the way. You're not alone, I'm with you every step of the way. I'm not going to leave you, I'm not going to forsake you, I'm going to be with you, don't be afraid. And in Psalm 73, he says, I was confused, I was trying to figure it all out, and then I realized, you've been with me this whole time. Yes, that's what God's trying to say. God has been with us, folks, this entire time. He's been there for us to reach out and grab His hand to say, I know I've not been alone. You've been there. If we keep reading in Matthew chapter 28, verses 19 and 20, this is kind of the go-to passage for this. Let's turn over there. And now, having explored this concept of God being with His people, let's read the Great Commission with that in mind. Matthew chapter 28, I'll begin reading in verse 16. Now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. When they saw him, they worshipped, but some doubted. And Jesus came and said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." What Christ did here is just said, you need to recognize exactly who I am. I'm not just the son of Joseph and Mary, the carpenter's son from Nazareth. I'm God in the flesh. You guys get that, right? You've lived with me for 3.5 years. You saw the things that I did. You saw me die on the cross and be put into the tomb. And I'm here now. You guys are all aware of this, aren't you? Therefore, verse 19, go and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things that I've commanded you. So you take what you learned from me and go tell everybody else. Which for 11 guys from the backwoods of Galilee to hear, it's a daunting task. 11 people to save the world, folks, and to save all the world's souls from this point forward, including ours. You can imagine they said, we are not equipped to do this. We are fishermen. We are zealots. We are tax collectors. We're not trained to go and change the world. What does Jesus say next? And lo, for pay attention, I am with you always, even until the end of the age or end of the world. He says, guys, you can do this. You have to do this. And I'm going to be with you every step of the way. And those 11 guys did just that. They changed the world through that message of the man they knew as the Son of God. Now, that mission is also unto us. We are the folks that came from the converts that were converts of the converts going all the way back into the first century. We just read it right here. We're a part of that chain. And therefore, that command to go and make disciples is unto us as well. And when we think there's no way in the world this small congregation can do anything in God's kingdom, we are absolutely wrong. Why? Because Jesus said he was going to be with us every step of the way. We are not alone. I have one more passage to read and then we'll close out our thoughts. It's in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 14. Hebrews 4 and verse 14. My call to action, if you will, my invitation to you to see what you can glean from this set of thoughts is not necessarily just go evangelize. That's good, but there's something a little bit more personal here for me, personally. So Hebrews 4 and verse 14. Having read all that, let's bring that conversation to this context. Since then, we have such a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast, hold firm to our confession that he is the Son of God. For we don't have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, right? We read that. But one who in every respect, every regard, was tempted like we are, yet without sin. So we have a God, Jesus, who not only knows what we go through, he went through it himself, so he can relate to our struggle of sin. Let us then, knowing all these things, let us then, with confidence, boldness, draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Not only do we have a God who wants to encourage us and remind us continually that He is with us. He wants us to come to Him for help when we need it. And we shouldn't be ashamed of that. As the children of God, we should be delighted to communicate with God through Christ, to tell Him exactly what we're going through and what we need from Him, since He is with us always and forever. And so whether it's taking the good news of Jesus Christ to the world, or it's something as simple as getting out of our bed in the morning that we find almost impossible to do in certain emotional states, we can look and see He is with us every step of the way. This morning, if you need any help in finding your way into Christ, if you don't know what to do to have salvation, or if you are a Christian who has fallen short, and we can assist you and lift you up and encourage you in any kind of way, we can help you whatsoever this morning. Please respond by coming forward as we stand and we sing.